This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 19, A Force Awakens. In the past three episodes, I have developed the story of Chinese education in late colonial Singapore from 1949 to 54. The British, in their hubris, sought to reshape Malaya's culture and society. They sought to cut off Chinese-speaking Singaporeans from their past and create a new pro-British Malayan identity based on English. In this way, they would leave behind colonies after decolonization, which were reliably pro-British. This massive attempt at social engineering naturally drew an equally massive response from Singapore's Chinese-speaking population, which did not want to see their culture and language destroyed. In episode 16, I explained how the Chinese succeeded in creating Nanyang University in defiance of the British colonial government. But in episodes 17 and 18, I explained that this made little difference. The real battle was over Chinese primary and secondary education, and here the government held all the advantages. They controlled the taxes, they made the laws, they could brutally beat up the people of Singapore and call it maintaining internal order and security. So as I mentioned last week, the students had been seeking confirmation that the colonial government would keep its promises and allow those who were still in school to postpone national service and those who were their family's sole breadwinners to be exempted. The government had promised that students would be exempted, but in the Federation of Malaya, the promises were not kept. So on 13th May 1954, a delegation from the students met with the colonial secretary about this issue. Now, keep in mind the students had broken the law. William Good, the colonial secretary, had extended the registration deadline by 10 days, so the students still had time to register. On 13th May, anxious students gathered outside Government House to await the outcome. As they waited, the riot squad arrived and brutally beat up the unarmed students. The public were outraged. A line had been crossed. This is the straw that breaks the camel's back. Up to this point, the negotiations between the Chinese educational community and government excluded the students. But the issue of education was, of course, of greater significance to the students who would have to live with the education and qualifications they received or didn't receive. Yet the community leaders and school management assumed that they could adequately represent the students. And it's also important to remember these aren't the students like we think of students today. We're children of peace. These are children of violence, of war, of repression. They had been repeatedly targeted and harassed and discriminated against by the government. They were inheritors of a long tradition of political resistance stemming from the New Culture Movement. Many were overage because of the war or simply because their parents couldn't afford to send them to school at a younger age. You know, back then, siblings might take turns going to school or a student might drop out when they don't have the money to go to school and then work for a year or two, then go back to school. So Chinese education was a much more fluid system than what we expect today. But because of all these reasons, the students would present a much more effective response to the colonial government than anyone anticipated. The night after the 13th May 1954 incident, over 1,000 students gathered at Zhongzheng High School to decide what to do. They decided to organize themselves for their own protection. To do so, they followed a very established model of associational democracy in Singapore. This is the same model that, for example, the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce was organized under. So in this model, students from each of the 8 schools represented elected 6 representatives each to form a Singapore Chinese Middle School's National Service Exemption Delegation, which in turn then elected a 9-member executive committee. They then first sought to follow very established traditional patterns of politics in Singapore and asked the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, the traditional leaders of the Chinese community, to mediate with the government on their behalf. So it's important to remember how traditional the students were when they started out, how they tried to follow the established process. They copied the elders, they organized themselves along the model of the elders, and they asked the elders to intervene on their behalf. The students met with the Chinese Chamber of Commerce and School Management on 19th May and emphasized that they wanted a peaceful and fair outcome. And there, and at a press conference again the next day, they again stressed they did not object to national service. They fully intended to register. They merely wanted a written assurance from the government that students would be allowed to postpone their national service till their schooling had been completed. And they also condemned some sections of the press, i.e. the Straits Times, for their quote-unquote distortion of facts. The government, however, pressured the school's management to close all Chinese schools indefinitely. But the management did not want to be seen to be caving into the colonial government, a colonial government which beat up unarmed students. So instead, the Chinese school management decided that school holidays would start 2 weeks early on 22nd May. But this announcement caught the students by surprise. Remember, no social media in 1954. News traveled a lot slower back then. So on 22nd May, over 3,000 students arrived at Zhongzheng High School to find it closed for the holidays. Students from other schools later joined them and a meeting of their elected representatives were held. Fearing that the police would again send the riot squad in after them, they dispersed after one night and issued a press statement repeating their position. The Chinese press praised this action as sensible, but they urged the students to accept the government's verbal assurances and register first. Once the government's objections had been removed, argued the newspapers, a compromise could then be reached. But the students believed, I think they knew, that if they registered, the government would have no reason to compromise. It was only their resistance to begin with that had forced the government to concede the principle that students should be allowed postponement. The students reiterated this at a further press conference on 24th May. They also called for the arrested students to be released and an open commission of inquiry held for the 13th May incident. But what the students didn't know was that the government had already decided their position. They were not going to talk to the students or even acknowledge the students. 13th May to them was a disciplinary issue. The Director of Education, David McLellan, called in the Chinese school principals and management and threatened them with tough sanctions. The representatives were forced to agree to greater disciplinary control of their students. They also agreed not to admit any students who had not registered for national service. Now, this clever move placed future responsibility for student activities on the school principals and management committees. This meant that the government could torture the students all they wanted. But if the students protested, it was the school principals and management committees who were at fault. And most of all, the government denied any liability on their part for the events of 13 May. It refused to reply or even acknowledge the students' public statements. It signaled its condescension and contempt of the students by framing the issue in purely disciplinary terms. And this was a happy outcome for the government. Internal memos between colonial officials declared that, quote, most responsible Chinese are now aware of the necessity of measures to restore discipline, unquote, which would then justify closing down and reforming the schools. So in a nutshell, the government beat up unarmed students, then blamed the students, then used that to justify closing down the schools. Brilliant, right? So the Chinese Chamber of Commerce was outmaneuvered and it timidly told the students they had to register before the chamber could help them. This, of course, was utterly pointless, was playing the government hands. And the students knew this and they realized the Chinese Chamber of Commerce was avoiding action. The students had been abandoned by their elders. There was no one who would stand up for them. They would have to stand up for themselves. Our story continues when we return. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Tan. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, A Force Awakens.
Welcome back.
The Chinese students had been abandoned by the traditional leadership of the Chinese community, by the people they looked up to and respected. They were adrift and alone. How could they resist the colonial government, which sought to destroy them and their way of life? Previously, the students had been afraid to occupy the schools in case the police raided the schools. But then a news report in the Nanyang Shangpao on 24th May pointed out that the police could not enter a school without the approval of the management committee, because it was private property. And the students asked their legal advisor, C.H. Ko, if this was true. And he said, yes. And so, frustrated, unable to determine any other course of action, and inspired by examples coming out of Indonesia and Japan, they resolved to occupy Chinese High until the government gave them a reply. At this point, they weren't even asking the government to meet their demands. They were just asking for the courtesy of a reply. Yeo Chan Boon, the vice chairman of Chinese High's management committee, and the principal, Cheng An Lun, tried to persuade the students to go home, but to no avail. Yeo reminded them that the government would use this occupation as an excuse to close the school down, depriving all of them of their futures. His very careful, stilted speech to the students, however, was judged by reporters present not to be aimed at the students, but calculated to demonstrate to the government that he had made his best effort to convince the students, thus absolving him and the school of responsibility. The students held another press conference where they expressed their disappointment at the failure of the Chinese Chamber of Commerce and its capitulation to the government, and the government's indifferent or even contemptuous attitude towards the students. The Nanyang Shangpao supported the students in its editorial. It explicitly linked the situation with the government's poor treatment of Chinese education and asked if the students would be so militant if Chinese education had not been systematically discriminated against. It suggested that students who were brave enough to risk their own futures to fight for principles would be the vanguard of Malaya's future. Readers' letters to the Chinese press also generally agreed that the real issue was discrimination against Chinese education, and the students were justified in their anger. But at the same time, they were putting themselves and the Chinese schools at risk by occupying Chinese High. As the situation deteriorated, the Chinese press and their readers urged the students to disperse to protect their own futures and for health and safety. But they did not criticize the students' values, their intentions. Meanwhile, the students wrote a petition asking for a written assurance on or before 8th of June for postponement of service for all students while schooling. And if the government would not do this, the students would accept the censure of the law and submit themselves en masse to jail. The petition was submitted to the governor through the Colonial Secretariat on the 5th of June. The next day, the students' petition to the governor was returned unopened because, quote-unquote, it was not submitted through the proper channels. They were not told what the proper channels were. So they resubmitted the petition by registered mail. 2 days later, McLellan returned the petition with the instruction that students' petitions should be submitted through the school management. And so this was done. But the problem is the petitions assumed that the government would respond either positively so that the students would get a positive reply, or negatively so the students would go to jail. But the problem was the government simply ignored the students. The students never received the reply. And so the 8th of June deadline passed with no developments. Another statement issued on 11th of June reiterated their promise to disperse as soon as they received a satisfactory reply from the government, or indeed any reply. But the government continued to ignore the students. Meanwhile, students started carrying out lessons with senior students acting as instructors. A steady flow of parents brought them food and cash and clothing. More students arrived. Within a few days of the start of the occupation, nearly 1,000 students were camping in Chinese High. Chinese High management and Chinese school principals urged the students to return home and to trust the Chinese Chamber of Commerce in its handling of the situation. But the students declined to do so. And indeed, why would they? On 21st of June, Catholic High School reopened a week earlier than the other 7 Chinese schools. It expelled 5 of its 6 elected representatives to the students' delegation. Several meetings were held between students' parents and the Chinese Chamber of Commerce to try to compromise, but to no avail. The government continued to ignore the students. Frustrated, the students went on a hunger strike. This was carefully organized, with 100 students exempted for orderly and security duties. At a 9 a.m. press conference following the decision, a spokesman emphasized that all they wanted was a direct, honest, proper response from the government to settle the issue. If the government felt that they were in the wrong, they would voluntarily submit themselves to jail. But the government continued to ignore the students. With the situation reaching crisis point, on 21st of June, Lim Soo Gan, member of Chinese High's Management Committee, went to the school accompanied by the principals of Zhongzheng Chinese High and Yuk Ing High Schools. Lim assured the students that the government would approve the applications for postponements if the students registered properly and all students would be readmitted when the schools reopened. The 5 expelled from Catholic High would be accommodated in other schools. The students erupted in cheers. After they registered themselves, they cleaned up the school and dispersed. They issued a final statement thanking the school management and urged all students to devote themselves to their studies. The Nanyang Shangpao, however, was not moved to celebrate. The situation was resolved, but it pointed out that discrimination against the Chinese educational system and its graduates continued. But then things took a twist the next day. The students read in the newspapers that Lim Soo Gan admitted that he had told the students, yes, your applications for postponements would certainly be approved. But he denied ever telling them that he was representing the government. And the day after, Secretary of Defense Davies denied that any assurance had been given that students would be granted postponement and emphasized that all applications would be solely granted on their own merits. Simultaneously, the government released a statement that the management committees of the 7 closed Chinese middle schools had agreed to re-register all of their students under stricter regulations designed to ensure discipline, including requiring a sponsor to guarantee good behavior and greater teacher oversight. Students who had been expelled would not be readmitted to any other school. Lee Kong-chian confirmed these regulations in a statement to the press. He regretted the government announcement of the agreement between the education department and the 7 schools. He said it made the schools look like they had betrayed the students and kowtowed to government demands. But that's what they had done. The students were betrayed. They were no better off than on 13th of May. And the government had never even given them a reply. In July, 7 students were charged for the 13th May incident for obstructing the police, not rioting. They were convicted and sent to 3 months imprisonment, which was the maximum penalty. The trial established that the police had taken excessive action and the students had no intent to riot when they gathered at King Albert V Park. It was a moral victory for the students, but they declared their intent to appeal. Their lawyer, C.H. Ko, tried to dissuade them, arguing that they had already achieved the best possible outcome. They refused and went to the Fajar defendants to seek D.N. Pritt QC. Now, the Fajar defendants were the editorial committee of the University of Malaya Socialist Club's newsletter, Fajar. Earlier that year, the government had accused them of sedition. D.N. Pritt QC had defended them and won. Now, the students sought Pritt to help them. And the Fajar defendants referred them to a young lawyer, Lee Kuan Yew, in order that he could bring on Pritt. Under the rules, a junior lawyer was needed to bring on a QC. Pritt's fee was crowdfunded. Parents and well-wishers chipped in. Leading members of the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, including Lee Kong Chen, also rather guiltily agreed to meet Pritt's $30,000 fee. Pritt, however, lost the appeal. And in the meantime, the government called up a number of students for national service. And despite the government's promise, it included 11 from senior middle 2 and 3, whose applications for postponement were denied. 3 refused to serve and were prosecuted. The exemption delegation angrily put out a statement quoting the Secretary of Defense statements of 12 May and 18th June, which explicitly promised exemption for senior middle 2 and 3 students. They wrote, quote, "The fact of today has clearly shown that we were not wrong in the past on insisting on written assurances from the government," unquote. On the 21st of September 1954, an amendment to the Registration of Schools Ordinance 1950 was rushed through the Legislative Council. It allowed authorities to close any school and suspend its registration immediately, instead of after 2 weeks, merely on suspicion of a violation of the ordinance at any time during the past 6 months. It shifted burden of proof onto schools, which now had to prove they had not been used for unlawful purposes. How do you prove a negative? The student's legal advisor, Lee Kuan Yew, condemned the ordinance, saying, quote, "The authorities still have had no evidence of any sign of communist activities in the Chinese schools, but they regard the students' opposition to the government's refusal to allow the students' postponement of service as communist disruptive activity, and under this pretext, they exercise stricter control over the Chinese schools." The Nanyang Shangbao was pleased by his speech and dubbed him, quote, "a friend of Chinese education," unquote. A wave of open letters from students and teachers and public appeared in the press. They accused the government of trying to destroy Chinese education. It was noted that the government had only sent copies of regulation amendments to Chinese schools. There was a clear double standard. For example, Western-friendly political publications such as USA Today, Taiwan Today, and The Free World were openly distributed to students at English language schools. The school's representatives and the Chinese Chamber of Commerce held an emergency meeting and issued a statement attacking the amendment ordinance as, quote-unquote, superfluous, inappropriate, and ineffective. The Chinese newspaper's editorial columns united in fiercely condemning the ordinance. The Chongqing Jitbao, the virulently anti-communist Chongqing Jitbao in particular, devoted four consecutive editorials to this issue. It accused the government of behaving like the communists, of adopting communist policies and tactics, and concluded that, quote, "we fear to imagine the consequences if this bill, which makes one shudder to read, is passed," unquote. So Governor Nickel tried to offer a sweetener to resolve the issue. In exchange for an increase in financial aid to $12 million, a statutory board would direct and supervise the administration of Chinese schools. The board would be chaired by the director of education and consist of a majority of appointed representatives of the Chinese community. Publicly, of course, the government declared that the stat board was a sensible, non-political plan. But internal discussions among colonial officials make it clear their aim was to bring Chinese schools under their control for eventual destruction. And the public were not fooled. Lee Kuan Yew remarked that the government was using taxpayers' own money to sugarcoat the bitter pill of the amendment ordinance. He attacked the board as a whitewash intended to ensure that Chinese schools and management were, quote, "compatible with colonial education policy and the interests of the colony government." He concluded, quote, and this is a genuine quote, "In a democratic country, legislative councillors must follow public opinion if they are not to be ousted at the next general election," unquote. But what of the students? They had been ignored by the government. They had been betrayed by the Chinese Chamber of Commerce. They were thrown to the wolves by their own school management and principals. But the students knew that the government's actions were entirely directed at them. At the same time, the meager progress made was also because of them. Without their protests, there may be no amendment ordinance, but there would also be no offer of $12 million in aid. In the past year, student groups and the public had provided stronger opposition to government discrimination than school management and the Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Now the students were performing duties beyond their station, for example, helping other students process applications for postponement for national service. And when the government later announced a new exemption category on the grounds of hardship, the delegation found itself helping non-students who had no one else to turn to. And so, inspired by the successful example of student unions in Britain, America, and elsewhere, they resolved to form their own union to be able to get their voice heard. And on 9th of October 1954, the exemption delegation announced their intention to form a Singapore Chinese Middle School Students Union. And this new force would go on to be one of the two great defining forces of Singapore's decolonization, alongside the labor unions. It was at this time, October 54, that the destruction of Chinese primary schools in the Federation occurred. As I mentioned in the previous episode, in 1952, the Chinese primary schools had surrendered control over school management in exchange for government funding. And now, due to a budget crisis, the primary schools were converted to national schools, which taught in English and Malay. Singapore's Chinese watched in horror as this happened, and this cemented a consensus in Singapore that control over Chinese schools could not be surrendered. Opposition to the statutory board solidified. And it is here the Chinese Chamber of Commerce destroyed its own authority. So on the one hand, it recognized that the situation was complicated, that consensus and unity in the Chinese community was paramount. And so it announced a survey of Chinese school management and community leaders and teachers, followed by a meeting of all Chinese public bodies to decide to accept or reject the government's new policy on Chinese schools. However, on the other hand, it still behaved as if it was in its traditional role as the voice of the Chinese community. And so before the community meeting could take place, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce authorized Yap Ping Gig to meet with the governor and present a 10-point counterproposal. The Chinese Chamber of Commerce's unilateral action caused anger and unhappiness among the rest of the Chinese community, who did not agree with its 10-point proposal. At the meeting, the governor rejected the Chinese Chamber of Commerce's proposals and decided to withdraw all offers of aid, even the original $3.5 million in his white paper from over a year before. The Director of Education announced that henceforth, Chinese schools could apply for full financial aid under the same terms as the aided English and Tamil schools. So the Nanyang Shangbao asked him the obvious question, what are the terms? And McLellan at this point was forced to admit that no uniform standard of control existed for the aided English and Tamil schools, thus proving that the government actually didn't care about the Chinese schools' financial difficulties. Its only goal was to bribe the schools to accept greater government control. Following this, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce subsequently abdicated its responsibility and leadership of the Chinese community on this issue and decided that, in light of the government's decision, it would not call the general meeting and would proceed no further on the matter. So, what does all this tell us? Well, first, over the past four episodes, we see how systemic government oppression eventually created the force that would oppose it. The government continued throughout this period to insist that there was some sort of web of conspiracy between ideologically, politically, and personally motivated people, including, of course, the communists, who were seeking to exploit the situation for their own gain. They ignored the evidence again and again of what the world really was like, to see the world that they wanted to see. But just ask yourself, what's more likely? That there was some mysterious conspiracy that no one had any evidence for? Or that 6 years of oppression, harassment and discrimination, along with the riot squad brutally beating up unarmed students, had created a situation where the students were as mad as hell and completely fed up and decided to take things into their own hands? Second, of course, in portraying the issue, in obsessively focusing on the issue as one of internal order and security, the government totally failed to learn its lesson. And the very next year, 1955, an incident would arise under very similar circumstances, which would lead to an actual genuine riot where people were killed. But if the government had stopped thinking about this as an internal order and security issue, and instead genuinely asked itself about the roots of the problem, if it treated people with more respect, perhaps needless death might have been averted. But of course, the government was not capable of that. They had a fixed worldview which they could not deviate from, because deviating from it would mean admitting that they had screwed up, that they were wrong, that they had created the situation to begin with. And finally, what of Singapore's decolonization? Well, this is the beginning of the big transition in Singapore politics. Up until this period, politics in Singapore still ran through a traditional petitionary model, an imperial model. You'll remember this from way back in episode 3, the colonial government appointed leaders for each of the linguistic communities. These leaders, who were usually rich merchants, represented the community's views to the government, although, of course, those views tended to be their views rather than the people's views. In turn, the government used these leaders to disseminate its policies and regulations to the community. And so anyone who wanted to influence government policy would work through the leaders who would represent them and negotiate on their behalf. For the Chinese community, these leaders were the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce. And so this is an age-old imperial colonial model. But the Chinese Chamber of Commerce's elite status and power was based on this really paternal hierarchy, based on wealth and tradition. Their wealth was tied to the colonial institution of capital accumulation. And this meant that the Chinese Chamber of Commerce was too bought into the current establishment, the current situation. They could not have a truly progressive agenda or truly propose any real change. Any effective coalition of the students for change would jeopardize their own leadership and their own financial interests, their relationship with the government, their access to power. For the students, they were unconstrained by any stake in the status quo. Indeed, the status quo discriminated against them. And so their willingness to engage in radical action actually enabled greater success. And in this, again, going back to some of the themes we brought up in earlier episodes, the students drew upon a wide variety of sources of inspiration to articulate and organize their movement. If you look at the press statements and their public statements and the writings that they left behind, they explicitly refer to their pre-war predecessors, to the Indonesian Pemuda, to contemporary British, American, and Canadian and Japanese student activities, and to Gandhian ideals of non-violent resistance. And in doing so, they were able to formulate and articulate a new approach to politics in Singapore. They discovered that the limits of anti-colonial action had loosened. The emergency regulations having been loosened, the government now preferred to ignore rather than repress these broad-based popular movements it disapproved of, not just the students, but Nanta. The government was no longer willing to resort to the same level of violence and repression as the emergency because this would undermine their commercial interests and their agenda for decolonization. And so this creates a new space for politics, a new space for anti-colonialism that they would, the anti-colonial movement would seek to exploit. Especially after the 1955 elections further transformed the political landscape. And so a new age has dawned in Singapore. This is the age of popular representation, of popular democracy. And Singapore's politics had changed, although no one quite realized it yet. Singapore's politics was now of mass mobilization, of direct democracy. Singapore's size and its highly urban population and its lack of traditional social hierarchy meant that the most successful politicians would now be those who could build up mass movements and then build up a coalition of mass movements of interest groups with common goals, put them together into a coherent party and contest elections. That was the future, but not many people realized it at the time. But everyone would really powerfully realize this next year in the 1955 elections. And so join us next week as we talk about this new age of Singapore politics and the rise of the great David Marshall. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjfam. See you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.